Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest George Lobono, who is the author of Alien Mind, The Thought and Behavior of Extraterrestrials. This book was originally published in 2010, and George has told me that he has more information coming out, a new book coming out. We'll be talking about this book and some other things that he has come across. It should be a fascinating interview. Thank you for joining us, George.
Thank you.
Well, I understand that you're an investigative reporter who spent a large amount of time interviewing and interacting with aliens of different kinds that are associated with our government and, I guess, other governments. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Okay. Well, actually, I started writing about ETs. But I was interested in the subject, but until 1995, I had no real direct evidence about ETs. But, of course, in 1995, what happened in my case was that I was contacted. Essentially, it was a mind-to-mind communication, and it was so much more intelligent than me. It was, you know, it was trying to hint around, initially, about what a fifth dimension, an extra dimension, would look like in sort of space, out in space, but it would be an extra dimensional sort of like kind of folding in a sense, but it's kind of a bending out in certain places into an extra dimension. I knew it wasn't me because, you know, I've been thinking about subjects like that for years, and I wasn't capable of that kind of graphic. And then it continued, and I continued to hint at, you know, more at who it was, being E.T., mostly leaving me the sort of, I guess you'd say, the incentive, just the time to investigate on my own and then, you know, sort of doing things at certain intervals. And this has gone on for years. So then I'm a contactee, I guess you could say, since 1995. Well, so I started writing a book about the thought and behavior of ETs because I was noticing that, at first you encounter ETs, you find that this is probably more or less without exception, ETs generally communicate using telepathy or kind of extrasensory, kind of remote sensing, because it's faster. You can say much more than just say with your mouth. And that's what they do, and they have whole networks like that, and that's where it gets interesting because, you know, sometimes we're kind of stuck in the, I guess how would you say it, like kind of an idea of concrete, almost as though we're sort of caught between the idea of like what maybe the Big Bang was or is or could have been and, you know, how we are now. And meanwhile, ETs come along and they keep suggesting, you know, the universe is much older than that. And that is kind of freaky because some people then think, wait a minute, how could the universe be older than, you know, the kind of the event horizon that we think of as the Big Bang? And that's about where my new book picks off because it begins with kind of, if you could say, a new sort of page in you, human and ET relations.
So, what you're describing is the majority of humans, at least in the past, have been very third dimensional. In other words, they can't conceive of anything of outside what their perceptual senses are sensing. But many of us have developed senses beyond our normal senses, our normal five senses, and have experienced like what you're talking about, telethought communication that is giving us information that we know we don't have. So therefore, we're being introduced to the higher dimensional realms, and it's happening more and more. I mean, more and more people are experiencing this. So that's why the book is so fascinating. It's a study, actually, of the psychology of what is going on with the aliens that are, you know, have been interacting with us probably since shortly after Roswell.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that the average person would hear us and think, okay, so fifth dimension, what is, how could you think of, say, an extra dimension? I could hint around it, you know, for example, the past is actually kind of in an extra dimension. The future certainly is kind of in an extra dimension. Another, probably the best example for extra dimension would be the idea of the universe. The universe would be everything that ever was, is, or will be. But among aliens, a good way of sort of seeing how they think of an extra dimension is how it's a new kind of science that they have. And the new book that I'm writing talks about, it mentions that at the outset, that, well, the new technology, certainly some people think, oh, the new weapons, but the new technology, the new sciences of ETs, you know, what's the most important? Well, to me, beyond a doubt, after since 1995, interacting with different groups of ETs, it's not technology at all. The most important sort of outcome or thing that what came out of contact with ETs is the new science of mind. It's just almost unbelievable because there's this new kind of energy. Well, it's not new at all. It's called scalars. And it's been referred to as electrogravity, also known as zero-point energy. As a matter of fact, a guy who won a Nobel Prize for discovering dark energy is making the universe expand faster rather than slowing down because of gravity. He was asked, you know, what do you think that dark energy is? He says, probably that zero-point energy. Well, zero-point energy is not something for machines only. Your mind can create this. And the question, some people are thinking, that, wait, how do you get zero-point energy out of a brain? It's this simple. Scientists do this. They take light, they might take lasers, and they focus them exactly at one point from exactly opposite directions. So these light waves come from, you know, two different points, and they converge. And they do that from along three different lines, like three different dimensions. Now what they do is the rolling hump in the light wave sort of coming from one direction is exactly opposite. It mirrors, it's timed, so that it's exactly opposite sort of the rolling hump of the light coming from the opposite direction. So what happens is when light waves do that, they cancel out. It's called standing wave. Well, that's right. What gravitic is, but you can do that in your mind because you can converge sort of like energy just sort of half spin, half flip. It's sort of like you're converging energy and use the larger envelope, the larger part of your brain, to sort of contour that. And it does what's a kind of a new kind of, it's a resonance, really. They call it scalar electromagnetism. Some people call it electrogravity, also gravitics. What it does is it sort of resonates, it sort of tunnels down into the place where you're sort of like, you know, doing this in your mind, but at the same time it's resonating out across a big, like a vast, I guess you think of it as a bubble of space, could be light years. But the interesting fact is this. There's a scientist, his name is Dr. Eldon Bird, PhD. He was a physicist with a PhD. He worked in the Naval Surface Weapons Laboratory, and he was talking about this new kind of energy. He was saying that these new scalars, there's something interesting about them, and that is that it takes almost zero time for them to resonate from one place to any other place in the universe. But that's the basis of alien mind telepathy communication. So all of a sudden, it just completely takes the lid off of the old idea of, I don't want to say just boundaries, but of like the possibilities, because, you know, alien mind sort of interactions become this, it's scalars, the mind, your mind, anybody's mind is capable of this. And all of a sudden, it's like it's not just one planet, it's like, think in terms of like a whole galaxy or multiple populations, ecologies, mixes, out into other galaxies even, and even other galaxy groups, you know, superclusters. You know, and that's what ETs do. And some people think, well, you know, wait, mind interactions on that scale, how is that possible? Well, it's because ETs have a different idea of their identity. Our idea of identity tends to be sort of an individual I, me, mine, my little house, you know, things I do, where I'm going to go or what I'm going to get for my life. With ETs, there's kind of like two steps of this. The first step is they have an identity that's a social identity because of these mind interactions. So among those gray alignment ETs or any other ETs that may be native Milky Way alien ETs, all the ETs people have seen, they notice the ETs are sort of like they're accustomed to, they're used to this idea of just mind interactions. But they can communicate a whole lot of information. It's really interesting. It's sort of like, it's kind of a little bit faded down a lot more and also in sudden bursts. It's like your mind can do like faster shifts of just like information just, you know, almost instantaneously back and forth across certain ideas. And that's what's interesting because among ETs, the universal language of ETs is more or less just the ideas themselves. There's one alien contact account, it's called the Contact with the Yarga, and the aliens in that, who supposedly live 10 light years away from us, maybe the nearest some of the nearest native alien neighbors, they're saying that language only mirrors, thought and ideas. The ideas are what's communicated. So the communication is essentially universal. And this is, I know this sounds radical to some people, because what I've just been outlining for you is the reality for ETs. Some ETs are kind of a little bit more cautiously conservative about this, but it's that mind interactions go universal, and you interact with, like, larger, like, clouds of mind, in a sense. I know it sounds freaky to some people. It's like, you know, in mind-to-mind interactions, it's like you're inside almost like a phenomenal cloud of, like, it's a different kind of physics. Much more can be communicated, and that's what's going on with ETs all the time. And I have, there's some new developments with me I'll get into in a little bit, though, that actually make this even more interesting because, you know, the new book is discussing a subject that I don't think anybody else has written about yet. And I'll tell you
I doubt it. I don't think they have.
And that subject is this. Okay, so maybe for people not used to if you're not familiar with astronomy, you may be aware that in about the last two and a half years, there was a satellite. It was called the Kepler satellite. It went up, and I think it was run by NASA and I think some major university back east, different universities. And so it goes up. It's looking at stars, 153,000 stars, reached out a few thousand light years, away from us in our part of the galaxy, but. And they're looking for how many stars would have planets that would be habitable, because they could look and see when the star passed in front of the planet, it would dim the light. And now their estimates, they saw a lot of planets, thousands actually. And now then their estimates were that maybe like 2 or 3% of all of the stars in the Milky Way, probably every other galaxy, would have habitable planets in them. Mm-hmm. But there's a new development. Now here's a new development that changes everything. And this is where my book goes, and actually has been gone in this direction also, ironically, is that the red dwarf stars in the Milky Way and, I guess, every other galaxy in the universe are about three times more numerous than the ones you see with your eye. When you look up in the night sky, you see these whitish or bluish stars, the big ones, the higher mass. But the red dwarfs are about like 1/10 to maybe 1/100 the size of our sun. You cannot see them with your naked eye, and there are three times more of those than the ones that you see with your naked eye. So if you look up the Milky Way sky and you see all those stars, and well, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Just imagine that there are three other stars there that are around or in between each one of those for every one that you see. And the interesting subject now about red dwarfs is this, is that scientists are saying that up to between 50 to 100% of the red dwarf stars, and those are 3/4 of the stars in the Milky Way, 50 to 100% of those should have between 1 to 3 planets on them that would be habitable in the near orbits. Now, so remember, you imagine like you're looking at a star that is kind of reddish because it's fainter. It is kind of reddish. It's almost like you're looking it is like you're looking, you'd be seeing infrared light, the kind of stuff with night vision. That's what they'd be seeing. It's like they're seeing energy. That's 3/4 of the stars of the universe, and scientists expect that all the oldest life of ETs is going to be on planets surrounding those red dwarf stars. And that's where my book sort of picks up, because my book now is showing, I've had these interactions that have been going on for years, where populations have been saying, the universe is much older than the Big Bang. And just got used to that, because other people have heard it too. Well, now the populations have come out and they've said that their populations that live around, well, I'll give you an example, the nearest red dwarf star to us is called Proxima Centauri. Ironically, it is the closest star, because the nearest star system is called Alpha Centauri. And it's three little stars, two little whitish ones, and there's one red dwarf star. It's called Proxima. And instead of 4.3 light years like this system, this one comes 3.7 light years. It's closer to us than any other star. Mm-hmm. It's a red dwarf star that will last 4,000 billion years. That's 4 trillion years. Now, what red dwarf populations have been saying in their context is, it sort of takes the lid up. They say they already are thousands of trillions of years old. Our idea of the Big Bang is just like a sort of form that the Milky Way's black hole will sort of wash what looks like whitish in the spectrum. It goes through its cycle, but the red dwarf stars endure beyond that, and that's, of course, what astronomers are already saying. But now we have these red dwarf populations that are coming out, and they're doing these contacts. And what's the most interesting of all in their contact is, like, you're probably looking at my book and thinking, like, oh, it's interesting because it talks about abducting gray alignment ETs and how that is seen as being a violation of humankind and, like, dirty deals done with a kind of corrupt human regime. I guess, again, of course, gray, sort of in gray-related, those, large-eyed, everybody knows what I mean by grays, and they're sort of related aliens, doing all of that, according to, many, many reports. It's kind of basically a consensus among all the people who do research on ETs these days, who really get into the depth of it. Well, anyway, turns out that the gray alignment ETs are just a very young population, because they're only reportedly something like their oldest ETs maybe 18 to about 30 billion years old. Not trillion, pardon me. The old idea of the Big Bang was, 13.7 billion years. We have these other ETs. Along come the red dwarf ETs, and they say that they've been around their populations for up to 1,000 billion years, and probably considerably longer than that. And so you have these populations, and you look at them and you think, now wait a minute, all of a sudden, everything is looking different. Because I'm not kidding you, a year and a half ago, mm-hmm. certainly when I wrote my first book, we were looking at thinking in small minority populations, maybe stars would have habitable planets, and then they might grow, some would grow, some wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're looking at a situation where the Milky Way alone poses the easy possibility there is between 150 to 300 billion or more red dwarf star systems with habitable planets in them. So in other words, like many old. So the universe is just fantastically older than we ever thought. And like the gray line with ETs has come in and seem to be colonizing, overgrown, and very large as a population, although from another galaxy that's about 14 million light years away from us. They're seen as like they're coming in a kind of reckless move, overgrowth, red dwarf ETs, red dwarf star systems, planets, ETs, populations have just said that they had to learn with an ecology of like a slower, how should you put it, more kind of more easygoing kind of slow ecology, because their stars last for 4 trillion years. What do you do during that time? Do you just waste it and that's it, it's over? You have to develop a different kind of ecology. And it's a different kind of planet. Their planets face their suns normally, I guess, as far as we know. And one side of the planet faces the sun the whole time. The other side is just really cold. So it's different. Hmm. It's the majority of the universe. It's the oldest populations. They say they've come out and they've tried to show, and they have a convincing way of showing that their mind networks, after you've been out sort of like expanding and sort of checking out, contending with other mind networks among ETs, I know this sounds unusual to some people, but that's where it goes. It's sort of open space, and it's like beyond any regime, and that's how most mind interactions sort of go and feel. Then you find these red dwarf ETs, and they'll literally show you that their whole the networks of mind that they've, you know, of these older populations are literally universal. And I see that's a new development, because when I wrote Alien Mind, the first book, I was wondering if there was any really, you know, comprehensively universal network out there that would make sense of the universe. And along come these red dwarf, well, populations living on planets around red dwarf star systems, and it's like everything is different. Because they're older, they're more civilized, they're vastly beyond the gray line with aliens, and yet they just, you know, I was out in my, I've seen like one flying disc right out over the field where I live, but I've also seen like a display by some of these populations that have to do with red dwarf ETs. It wasn't their physical craft, but they're just showing me like this kind of, I guess you could say, a visual graphic out in the night when I'm out standing in this field looking at the stars and no moon, just a really good view of about 15 different populations. Sort of typical alien-looking big heads, you know, mostly kind of lightish skin, I guess, or, you know, or lightish to like us or somewhere like tannish somewhere, not dark. And different color eyes and stuff. But in two or three of the populations had this light behind them to show like a reddish light to suggest that they're red dwarf populations. So it's kind of like they're the older, more educated populations. They're sort of like showing the populations that they already sort of have some relations with, and that's just in our immediate vicinity. So, I mean, what I'm saying, just what my new book is going to be saying, is that instead of people sitting around and thinking, ooh, wow, you know, we're sort of stuck with these abducting, kind of very colonizing, overgrown, sometimes really scary, manipulative, sometimes conflict-manipulating populations like the Greys, aligned with literally or somehow the Greys' planet was destroyed when they were supposedly, quote, trying to help the Greys get their act together.
Right.
That wasn't right, you know, and it didn't look good for their whole, like, approach. All of a sudden, you can just forget those aliens, because the aliens that live right here in our immediate vicinity are parts of networks that are these red dwarf populations on red dwarf star systems that are just phenomenally better. They don't come in. They don't come in and force their way around. They don't come in and push you around. That's how their ecologies have endured. I mean, yeah, there's difference. I guess suppose there are differences between some of these, especially the ages of different groups of populations among them. But they are a network, and they show you that. And everybody's used to that out there. And the weird, the interesting thing is that it's more about how mind. I mean, this is what's interesting for them. Mind interactions are so interesting and so beautiful, and there's so much intricacy in it because they see how the whole universe can last, and they've kind of solved their problems. That it's only when you begin to do that that you find this second, it's not a second depth, it's this whole other sort of scale of interactions. It's like the universe is the collective conscious is also self-aware. And so when you're out in that, it's not only creatively self-aware, it's just like, oh, it's like it's a cultural thing. Among these older populations, there are these cultural sort of, you start to learn things that you would never have even thought about before when you start interacting with these ETs. And it's about like social norms, cultural, like how ideas of like who and where sometimes are almost not even played in, but everybody is sort of playing along, you know, and what I mean for the mind interactions. That's where this new book is going. It's kind of a challenging subject because the populations surrounding these, that live on planets surrounding these red dwarf stars, they're literally redefining everything, because now we finally see who could really, I don't want to say run the universe, but who really has their finger on the pulse of the whole ecology of the universe. It has to be them. They have to be the oldest, most advanced. And it's really interesting because it changes. To me, it's like it expands the scale, but it gives us a very clear, specific idea. I'll give you an example. You can get on your cell phone and put on one of these apps, and you're looking at the stars in what are called the infrared spectrum. And again, that's like the red dwarf ETs, because that's where that kind of red is. And you can see where all those red dwarf stars are. So you hold that thing up, you can point it any direction, look at, you know, down below through the Earth or up in the sky, and you'll look at what you see, and you'll see where all those red dwarf stars are all around each one of those stars. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to remind take something from page 97 that I think is really important, that your second book is going to go into in detail. The statement that honesty expands and connects through extra dimensions, while corrupted minds tend to collapse within themselves due to singular defects of character. So, you know, if the Verdants and the Greys, especially the Verdants, have defects of character, which I think you've pretty much shown in your book that they do.
Yeah, there's something going on there. It's definitely.
And the Cabal has defects in character, which we know they do from history, that they will not be able to expand through extra dimensions. And I'm curious to get your take from your alien communication or ET communication.
Yeah, like how does that?
What are we about to go through? Yeah, because they're telling us.
I would say
us.
It's like this. Think about. Like how should you put this? Some people used to say it's like you go into a different idea of density, and that's, I think it was very misleading, because it made people think it was all about like gravitics and about density. With these new ETs, the thing where it's going now, it's like this. In like the universe of, how should you put it? It's like you have such advanced, evolved ETs, and yet they really love to look at a planet like this and see how far people have advanced once they find out about ETs, and like how people just sort of, you know, become a little bit more, how should you put it, more socially kind of considerate once they're aware of like what the universe is like. And so for them it's entertaining, and they watch it, and these Verdants come along, and the Verdants are very pushy, and it's like there's abduction, there's force, there's pain, there's inflicted. They take young children, they force things on them, there have been abuse. They've apparently manipulated conflicts. They destroyed the Greys' last planet. And there's an older population that sort of goes with the Verdants. They essentially pretty much control them. It's, again, it's that older, about maybe 18 billion or a little bit older population of aliens, and they're not red populations that grew out of... and I've looked at this very closely because it's a very important distinction to make. One of them even expressed that kind of a worry about red dwarf star populations living on planets surrounding red dwarf stars, because there's so many and they're so far beyond like this gray line, these gray line ETs. And it, for me, it was a very telling moment. It was like, I was like, what? You know, so I thought they would look at us and say, try to act like, you know, we're more advanced than you, therefore we're way better off. We're more in with these red populations living on red dwarf planets. And you know what? That was not the case in what the ET was communicating. It was instead, it was kind of like, how should you put it? All ETs have to get along when you have big-scale interactions. But you go back to where these Verdants are, or even like the older ETs with them, look at any one of the galaxies where there's two galaxies are located. One, the Verdants, galaxy M83, a big spiral. The other is called Centaurus A, reportedly this older population that, you know, that sort of pretty much runs Verdants. It's like they're billions of years old, not just 229 million like the Verdants. So they're older. But in their own galaxy, Centaurus A, they would still only be something like one out of about every 400,000 to 500,000 star systems. The red dwarf, the population surrounding stars red dwarf stars, just vastly outnumber them even there. It makes the universe, it just, every, all of a sudden, you know, it's a, these gray limit ETs, they look like, well, you know, so they're a big population, but they're also pushy. They're considered primitive because they do not know equal consideration. It's like, you know, when you, there's, you, you look at a population, think of, when a population begins to grow too much, then the populations around them have been around for much longer, look at these red dwarf stars. They look at them and they think, like, what are you doing? You know, the universe is already very civilized. It's almost beautifully civilized. And it's once you figure out the ecology, you really have a nice, nice life, and especially in a galaxy like the Milky Way, where it's not a, a big problem case. You have three and a half billion years before you merge with even Andromeda. And by then, we're going to be just phenomenally advanced ETs, I guess you'd say. But why would you, you know, why would you want to grow? If you grow too large as a population in a fast way, and you're not even like one of these, you know, just many billions, tens and tens and tens, maybe like hundreds of billions of years old as a population, you look kind of bad because you're not respecting the ecology, and you just kind of like you look like a cage put around certain star systems to some ETs. I know it sounds weird to some people because we're talking about, again, ET relations that, well, you know, some people may not know this, but one, if you're really looking at the realistic scale of human interactions with ETs, right from the beginning, from Roswell, the Roswell being gray alignment ETs, gray alignment ETs coming from a distant galaxy. There's about 150 galaxies that are closer. Most of those are smaller, but there's, you know, dozens. There's about like 10 big ones closer to us in that gray alignment, those gray alignment galaxies. Well, we've been intergalactic right from the start. Roswell was intergalactic. It brings in intergalactic concerns. And so it's not only just consciousness of just your star system. You sort of have to get an idea of, I don't want to say the norms. It's all about the mind. The mind, you know, in mind sort of resonance, mind communications, you learn it's like more about how ETs feel about themselves and other ETs. And you start to really swim in that. It's just like it's a big ocean out there, and you have to be competent, and you have to sort of, you know, be aware that there could be, you know, like the gray alignment. You have to be aware that ETs would simply try to abuse your sensitivities for reasons of resource advantage. And that pretty much brings up, like you're saying, you know, we're looking at dirty deals with some part of the possibly the human, a kind of a cabal that has control of black budget weapons. And, you know, there's talk of narcotics trafficking done by them and other crimes. And they use CIA, and they're just using kind of like, you know, things like the Federal Reserve Bank, according to my best sources. And it's become a problem, I guess, in a sense, for not just the United States, but for, I think it's the idea of, like, the free discussion of ideas, because we're aware of ETs, ETs and their science are very interesting. They kind of take the lid off, and they're all equalitarian, but there's not always... they're not always, you know, treating each other equally, you know, between populations, I guess you could say. But, you know, like, according to these red populations surrounding red dwarf, on planets surrounding red dwarf star systems, so they're showing that there's a universal network that really works. And it's like, it's mind interactions where it's like beyond any single regime. They're not just one regime. There are many different populations that grew up, that developed on many, in many different systems. It's fantastic. But it literally works. It's just literally beautiful. It's not like policed. It's not government. It's just, it's kind of like awareness and knowledge, I guess, is what you could say. It's interesting.
So have you come across something, an intergalactic federation type organization that is the meeting of the minds?
Okay, so you have to be careful when you use words as ETs. I'll give you an example, two examples right now. Like you said, the word federation. Federation always implies a strong, centralized state. And it probably, we've heard the Star Trek thing. Mm-hmm. People think the federal government, you know, it's like, it's a strong, central state. Well, and the idea in the idea of these gray alignment ETs, they have a strong, centralized, it's essentially administration of all of the planets in their system. The Verdant have supposedly, I think there are 246,000 planets. And every one of those planets, believe it or not, even down to rotation of crews that are out in space, reports it back to their original home planet in that galaxy, M83. Same for the other ETs with them. They report back to their, you know, the older ETs. They have another, their old original planet. It's bizarre. It's centralized like that, and they have, you know, in alien mind communications, it's not just, oh, you know, hi, how are you? You know, I'm glad that you have feelings. they have psychotronic networks where they have technology that can essentially record, track. The big controversy with the gray alignment, with the grays, the so-called Zetas, the, my opinion, the Nordics, the Pleiadians, and all those that I'm, in my opinion, and according to the ETs that I'm interacting with, have for years, those are all related to the gray alignment, and they're like hybrids of their breeding program. They're being used for like a an approach of a colonizing group of aliens that literally destroyed and may, appears to possibly or probably even done so deliberately, the Gray's planet in thousands of years ago. And the report was that it was in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Now, that's a scary, weird thing, and you don't want to let that distort your whole sense of ETs, because that's not really the norm, I think, among like among our neighbors. It's just something that, you know, that's what gray alignment ETs are like. And so they come in, and, you know, it's like, so the big questions arise. And it's like about the ecology. It's about, like, would they really respect your sense of your, if you were to say, for example, we were to say, you know, we're very independent-minded. You look at the United States. No one here is going to say, oh, it's fine. We'd like to be colonized by ETs and be pulled into their alignment. And but how do you convince them of that? And that's the problem, is when you've got people who sort of walk behind the backs of human regimes, you know, like President, well, Eisenhower is essentially when it began. It was a kind of a Rockefeller family coup where they convinced Eisenhower that he would no longer have to worry about being called before the Senate or somebody has to testify and say, what do you know about these, quote, ET-related programs, where he has to tell the truth or be impeached. So they tried to tell him, that's what we're going to do. We're going to put these programs and under control of, you know, like semi-private sort of black budgets because they're ET-related stuff. And it never came back to the president, except for maybe Bush Sr., who was reportedly, well, you know, he had all these. It was a different kind of a case. And that is essentially that, you know, it's allowed, essentially. The weird thing about that is that by the secrecy that that regime has imposed in trying to monopolize all their interactions with these gray alignment ETs, and they seem to have allowed them to have backdoor access to things that, you know, it's been like squabbles and there have been skirmishes. I mean, there have been reports about up to maybe 150, maybe 300 human pilots that since 1947 were shot down while they were pursuing what they thought were just invasive craft flying over the U.S.
Right.
You know, it isn't all just like, oh, they just thought these were nice ETs and then, you know, just started taking technology from them. There's been back and forth skirmishes, deaths, and even shot, being shot down.
I'm real familiar with that because I was in the Air Force and I hung out with pilots on alert. And basically there were three different encounters. One would be MiGs, that played cat and mouse. One would be low-flying airplanes with full of drugs trying to, you know, go under radar. And the third would be extraterrestrial crafts. I mean, those are the three things that they got scrambled for, you know.
Yeah, so here you are, guys. So today you might see MiGs, you might see drug planes, or you might see ET.
You might see an ET, right.
Normal day, you know, be back by 5
p.m. That's right, yeah. No, I know that to be true.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's how it is for those people. And then there's pressure reportedly to not talk about it too publicly. Or certainly they weren't till the end of the Cold War.
No, they can't.
But, yeah, after the Cold War, because obviously for your career, if you talk about those kind of things so much for your military and flying career. However, since the Cold War...
Oh, guess where I was? Guess where I was stationed?
Where?
I was stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And guess what? Several of my patients, high-ranking officers, told me. They had seen live aliens. These are individuals that, you know, had no reason to lie to me.
Wow.
I was told by several people that they had seen live aliens.
Later on,
I find out what Wright-Patterson Air Force Base really was. Isn't that interesting?
What did they see them, like, just, were they
saw them.
Or were they just interacting?
Well, they saw them at the base, you know, where they had been brought from downed aircraft.
Yeah, right, Pat. Yeah, so, I mean,
right, Pat was where they took all the live and dead aliens. Yeah, and
they must have one of those. What do they call it? A Faraday cage. You know, they have like wiring electricity surrounding the whole base, so that if they have like grays or like gray alignment, gray like flying craft, they can flip a switch, and all this electricity produces kind of a magnetic effect that doesn't allow them to extract either the ETs or the technology. And that must be, I guess Wright Pat must have been the first, one of the first to be like that, because since the Roswell, you know?
Yeah, I think, that was where the Roswell bodies were evidently brought. It was to Wright Field. It wasn't Wright-Patterson Air Force Base yet, but that's where the reverse engineering took place, because, you know, that was what the base was good at. I also wanted to tell you that I actually called Colonel Bearden, who lives in Alabama here, and told him about your book. He had not realized that you had used his stuff. And it was beautiful the way you did it, because if you go on Colonel Bearden's website, it's not nearly as understandable as what you've done in your book to understand electrogravity. So I thank you for that, because it was...
Especially, I noticed when I was writing the second book that I was trying to get people from zero to kind of like a sense of resonance across this kind of this gravitic resonance that the mind can do. And I realized I was doing it better than I had done in the first book. So I went back and changed the first book and tried to make it so simple that it's like, you know, it's the science in the field, but it's, you know, it's not like I'm throwing all the equations at you. You're going to actually be doing this. If you read about it, it's not just like it's something for a laboratory. It's actually the human mind can do this stuff, and that's what's interesting. It's easy. It's easier than people think. What I was going to say is that, you know, I noticed that in the gray alignment, well, no, sorry, not the gray alignment, in the black budget sort of elements, I guess you could say, like, how should I put it? Like the old school sort of the ones who were, like, closest to, like, say, the Nazis, the ones who were the worst, the biggest war profiteers, the ones who are closest to, like, say, narco, you know, everybody knows what I'm talking about. Those people. Well, they had this, it was kind of a coup. I think Howard Hughes was, if you recall, Howard Hughes reportedly had possibly some down technology. And there was also, I think it was kind of like a Mellon family. The Mellons owned Mellon Bank. They owned aluminum. They owned General Electric. And that's where they came into the picture because of what's called radionics. And that is like, how do you make gravitics? Mm-hmm. And so the Mellons and the Hughes, sort of aviation, they had kind of like an alternative to what was, I think, a problem in that Eisenhower referred to in what was called his farewell address. He was talking about the military-industrial complex. And that was this convergence of Rockefeller and, I think, DuPont. And then the question, like some of the organized crime mixed into this power niche that used CIA to completely steal alien-related programs away from U.S. presidents after 1953. And, you'll read about this in many books, in Salo's book, in Richard Dolan's new book, in Timothy Good's book. Many of us discuss the subject because it's very important in terms of like where we're going with this new technology and new science. So they sort of tried to steal away control of it from the president, but the thing is that what's happening now is that there's a change of generations, that these old families that had you were using this black budget structure for their own purposes, there's a craft is called the TR-3B. It's a flying triangle, right? Well, that thing was last seen flying in 1994, I think Timothy Good's book is talking about how, about somewhere like 1994, one of these TR-3B triangles seen lowering, flying to the Bellingham, Washington sort of like field of what's Boeing. And, of course, DuPont family owns Boeing. So here's this thing flying in there. And also, there's this other craft that's, if you saw it in the Black Vault, John Greenwald's, Black Vault. There's this photo a few months ago of this craft scene. It's a guy going along in a car. It's a convertible. It's a dark, and he's right near St. Petersburg, Florida. Pops, he's got the window, the open top, and he takes a shot with, so I don't know how he did it. He's got this thing. It looks like Star Trek. It's got this, but unlike the TR-3B, it has the torus. In Star Trek, you have the torus, let's see, is where they had the energy. In this thing, it was the other way around. The energy was somewhere else. In this thing, they have a torus. It's a cyclotron up. It's like a spinning magnetic plasma with counter-threading sort of, gravitics. It does the gravitic stuff, and it has dropping down in these two like little sort of tubes. Below it are these about 40, 60 feet wide. Are these where the people are, and they have a little bit of it does gravitics with the lift of gravitic, and then it has sort of propulsion, probably jetting or rocketry to make it just almost disappear. So this thing, these two things, the TR-3B is being seen over one of the families' airfields from the corporation, and guess what? St. Petersburg is where the DuPont family had their banking, and it's like the narco coast, and the St. Petersburg is where the DuPont family also owned St. Joe's Mineral. They had all their money down there, and so all of a sudden you see what look like these black budget craft appearing in ways that look like it's almost favoring the idea of stolen and or stealing more power for private sort of display and use of certain certain families, you know? I mean, it's just bizarre. And this is what Eisenhower was talking about. This is what, you know, there's a guy who's talking about Eisenhower even threatened that he, you know, in 1950, 53 was the Rockefeller coup. They took power, they took the ET programs away. In 1958, according to, well, it's actually Steve Bassett's most recent disclosure conference, they had a guy there who said he was one of the CIA people that, or one of the Army people, went to go to, for Eisenhower told them to go to Area 51. He was supposed to tell them that if they didn't tell Eisenhower, let him, let his people come to see what's in this Papoose Dry Lake part of Area 51, it's like 13 miles south, then Eisenhower was personally going to lead the first army from Colorado. This is 1958. And invade that base. And he said, we're going to tear
Area
the
51,
place.
Yeah,
tear the place apart. And it's like, what are you talking about in his farewell thing? There was a coup to steal the stuff away from the president. He didn't know, and this is one base. And he was, I think Eisenhower may have thought, they're actually letting aliens base themselves on this plant. There's a story of the Tall Whites, there's a story of these Grays, there's a story of different places where it was actually like one or two places supposedly worked out behind Eisenhower's back, and it would have been this, like, you know, the Rockefeller coup. And so all of a sudden you see the situation where it looks like the president was cut out, a Rockefeller group came in, took control of this and control of the human future in terms of they already owners, part owners of the Federal Reserve Bank, and they've got this ET technology, and in addition, you know, it's like they were just doing stuff that, you know, they were using it in a way that was totally unconstitutional. And so now we're looking at a situation where that old regime is like old, or some of those people are old and dying, and it's like their idea of power is no longer stable. They're looking at, you know, after 2008, the melting down of the economy. They're looking at a situation where people can just, well, you know what's going to happen. When people find out, I think what's doing is people are finding more and more about ETs. They're taking the lid off. Nobody's going to lie to them about things that they know that are already true.
Right.
But the ET subject is going to take the lid off of everything. It's going to, you know, science, consciousness, studies, possibilities, and, you know, all this little private cabal is going to look like they're extremely vulnerable at that time. And it's happening right now. You know, people are finding out more and more with time. It's, you know, mainstream news. The last National Geographic poll done in 2007 showed that 80% of the people in this country, that's adults, think that ETs have already visited this planet.
Yeah, and actually it's much higher in college graduates. So that's an interesting statistic. I was there when Bob Dean told a group of us that when he was working side by side with the aliens, that he experienced walking into something that looked like an elevator in at the base they were at in the U.S., and then there was kind of a wave of energy that passed through him, and when the doors opened up, he was in France. So that technology evidently has been here for quite a while, using electrogravity.
People,
I mean, that would be like an elevator using it rather than a craft. But
some people would think, like, now how could you do that? And what I would say, like, gravitics are like this. It's like Corso, Colonel Corso. He was the Eisenhower White House, and, you know, like the Army guy who worked on downed ET stuff. He said that the aliens are able to fold gravity. It's like they fold it around their craft. So, like, when they do an abduction, when they literally move a person out through a wall, it's the gravitic waves are like they're sort of like tighter, more condensed, folded resonance, and it's like, imagine like a wave that passes through a solid because it's in a wave form, in a sense. It just goes right through. It's in, they have this is a, you know, it's a kind of technology. It's going to change a lot. It will certainly change information sciences. Certainly will change.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, I think ETs caution that you don't want to do all of your energy with, like, gravitics instantly, because it's more about research, information science, and, like, medical diagnostics, things like that, and cosmology, you know. Limited travel, because, you know, with ETs, it's just going to sound weird, but the older the populations are, the more evolved they are, the less they need to physically go someplace to really enjoy it, because they don't need a craft to sort of remotely sort of like almost visit that place in terms of resonance, or explore like the larger parameters of that place, I guess you could say, because that's how...
They have the ability to go not only anywhere within this dimension or whatever dimension they're in, but they can go between dimensions. You know, they can go up to another dimension and then back down, because it's all done in the mind.
Yeah, exactly. Some people think, like, how would you do this? So just, you have to remember that even the very atom itself has a resonant sort of kind of like gravitic, subgravitic kind of aspect. It's a counter-cycling of time. It's as though the universe on a larger scale is through black holes. It's like this. They're in black holes, in denser nuclear structure, and every star actually that puts atoms closer and closer together. It's called fusion. So in gravity, black holes, and all of that, things are cycling back in more closely, while at the same time the universe is expanding and the energy is moving outward. But the two are somehow, they're related, and that's where gravitics comes in. But the ETs are like this now. They're saying this. They're saying the more evolved ETs say it's not so much about just gravitics. Because if you think about gravitics only, you end up with like regimes that are kind of pushy and about almost like it's just like imperialism. What it's about is more like the extra it's the wave spaces of your gravitics. It's the extra spaces out there. It's the mind, the feeling, and everything. That's how you can get beyond, like, say, the gray line with ETs. They come along. How do you get beyond them? Well, you contour a larger resonance. It's a slightly larger, more open contour. It's beyond them entirely. And beyond that, too, in gravitics, there's kind of like there's a way that, like, information, there are whole streams of, like, information and mind interactions. They're, like, vastly more than that, that are just, like, threading around that. And it's like bending around wherever any other place is in the universe. And they don't see that. So if you're part of like a larger community, hence you know possibly even older, you get beyond gray alignment stuff pretty. I don't want to say easily. It took me years to do this. But don't ever think like these gray alignment ETs come along at the limit because they're not even significant in our galaxy. And you know it's like there are other much more advanced, much safer ETs.
Well, isn't it the law of attraction? I mean, we have this dark cabal running many of the governments. Not all of them, but many of the governments, and certainly controlling a lot of industry, banking, and other corporations. And it's the law of attraction. They're going to attract and interact with the group of aliens that are vibrating closest to where they're vibrating at. I mean, certainly the higher level, peaceful and more evolved aliens or extraterrestrials would not have gotten along with these people. I mean, I don't think they would have.
Not with those.
It's really the law of attraction. So it's just another universal law. And as long as the cabal is in power, which I believe is rapidly coming to a change point here, they'll be interacting with these lower energy verdants. But once they're not in power, then, when another government comes forth, a more peaceful and higher level government comes forth, and we'll be interacting with the higher level extraterrestrials because certainly they're waiting. I mean, I know they're waiting.
Yeah, and they're not necessarily waiting to come in.
To interact with, you know.
and they're not waiting to come in and occupy your planet, which is,
they're waiting to come in to help us with our problems, pollution, global warming.
Yeah, they're kind of remote. I really think that the only safe policy is to say, ETs are interesting, and we'll have a way station somewhere out there where they could ask to, on the edge of our system if they want to, come. If they want to come, they need to stop and ask. Otherwise, they're going to be approached by squadrons that are not going to be happy about them being in our system. I think we just can't allow ETs to base in our system. It's not that I don't like ETs. It's just that in order to be competent, you have to sort of learn how to live within your own ecology. And once you understand that ecology, then you're ready to understand other ETs and like what's going on between them. And that's pretty much where I think you can't have ETs colonizing because we're at too much of a disadvantage. It's just not good.
So your conversation with some of these more advanced civilizations, they've told you that there's a point at which civilizations become asexual.
The older ETs haven't really said, okay, now that's like that's part of the theme of the gray line with ETs. Yeah, there's a question. Mm-hmm. Look, pretty much the social sort of in the mind of the in the universe, the basic standards are non-sexual because, put it this way, it's like the idea of the mind in the universe is either half feminine or mostly all these other more evolved ETs who learned that their old idea of masculine was just junk, ridiculous, nothing, didn't pertain to reality. So they're all kind of like that. So even the sexuals, and I think many of these red dwarf ETs, most populations are probably sexual, but they've just learned how to control their numbers. And then the ones that sometimes you see this irony where you see, like, the worst, most abusive population oversize cases, like the Verdants and the from M83 and this older population from Centaurus A, which is by M83. Those cases, they're the ones going out trying to take over and control their plants and then convert them into essentially clone sort of products useful for their own sort of colonial expansion. Mm-hmm. Not sexual, but you know what I mean? They end up having more of them, but they're using them, designing them for their own purposes rather than not sexually reproducing. It's good propaganda, but it's the totally wrong thing, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just like something, it's bad for an ecology to have overgrowth like that coming in. It's just like they're slaves to technology, essentially, of an older population. Seems interesting to them, but, they're implanted with microchips, and they've got psychotronics that are almost like psychotronic policing in a case like that, where you look at other populations and they seem to be much more open about you've got to have good you have to have the ability to have critical judgment of your population and every other population is how they are.
So do you think, based on what some of the alien communication to you were, that we're at the cusp of a very significant change, probably a energetic dimensional change?
Yeah,
get beyond the cabal, we're going to get beyond our base nature after we go through that?
I feel that we are, certainly, and I think many people do. The only thing you have to be careful about saying is that we have to actually do this. We have to keep taking the lid off and just making people be honest. You know, why should we hide like ostriches? Hide the science. Hide the most interesting facts of our lives, because we're afraid that, what are we afraid of, you know? We're afraid that, you know, there's some sort of corrupt regime that's going to tilt it the wrong direction. No, people are ready for this information. That's why 80% think the ETs are already visiting here. So and that's going to change everything.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, too, it's not on the mainstream media, of course, but there have been a large number of fairly significant sightings over densely populated areas. There were some over New York. There were some over Paris, I think. And even in Atlanta, there were sightings of fairly significant sized craft by probably, you know, a huge number of people. And so it becomes more difficult to say that, you know, once you've seen one of these up in the sky, which I certainly have, it's very difficult to say that, you know, this doesn't exist.
Yeah, somebody's going to tell you it doesn't exist. You know that it exists.
Yeah,
and I also
know
about the ETs involved with it.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like,
yeah,
you can't go back to like acting like we're living in the 19th century, somewhere early in the 20th century where this stuff wasn't easily understandable. It's easily understandable now, and that's what's interesting, because people are starting to really pick up on it, but they're getting it's like everybody has their own sort of approach, and they get their own feelings, but it's almost it's almost intuitive. You know, women are a little bit better at it, I think. They just sort of, I don't know, women sort of complete the circle a little bit better, but they also, I think they're just a little more ready for contact than some men. Many, you know, not all men, but some.
Well, would you like to give your contact information, and do you have a name for your book that's coming out?
Oh, yeah. My new book is going to be called After Contact and Conflict. Should be out sometime this year. I thought it would be earlier, but, you know, red dwarf populations come along, and, well, our populations are in those kind of stars, and it kind of changed my book. Right on page 140, all of a sudden, well, I have to go back and edit everything because it's really interesting news. And, you know, it's not like, well, you'll see. Anyway, so I have a book. You can read my other book free on the web at alienmindbook.org. And if you go to alienmindbook.org, where it's free, or you could do a paperback somewhere, I don't know, Amazon. But if you go there, my email's on there and my contact information. And I always, like, if you contact me, go to my Facebook page. I have a Facebook page, George Lobono, and I write stuff from my new book. There's a lot of stuff from my new book, the recent stuff about red dwarf star systems populations. Really interesting, the way that they interact. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's a big step, I know, but it's actually, I think it's very important, because when you find the networks that literally sort of see the whole universe as like a resonant network, and it's not just like a thing to them. It's like they live. It's like their minds are like alive in that. It's hard to explain. It's not really hard to explain. Some people have a feeling for this already. You'll get there if you aren't there yet. You may soon know what I'm talking about.
Well, we will be introduced to this network of minds, you know, when we're ready. And some of us are introduced to it, you know, now, like through your book or through meditation groups or whatever. But certainly, you know, certainly I think that we're headed in a direction where we will be much more likely to be able to contact this group, this more stable group, and learn from them. And, you know, some technology, some spiritual technology. You know, we've been given information in our group about really amazing stuff that seems to be working. That has to do with, you know, multidimensional things with certain diseases and how things are interrelated. Things that, you know, you just would never find in any textbook or in any research paper, because they don't even think beyond three dimensions. And there's a lot more out there than just three dimensions. And
well, what I would say to people is that, you know, it's not all just mystical sort of insight. This the science of gravitics, and also the sort of the beyond gravitics would be sort of like the wave spaces of, well, just of scalar sort of flux. It's like it's a different sort of countercycling of time and just, you know, the universe. It's really very interesting. You get into this, and when you start to study it and feel into it, you get develop an intuitive feel. You have to be a little careful, you know. It's just like anything else, but I think it's very civilized, and you don't have to worry so much about, you know. It's not like crazy people are going to distort it. Crazy people, and also like you're saying, what I was saying earlier, you know, people who do wrong, they've built their own sort of enclosure. They don't see it.
Right.
Everybody else sees it.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You see everything else that they don't see. Because you have to tell them the nature of our mind network is the good only, is, you know, the understanding,
that's
the soft,
true.
The gentle, the non-violating. And if you're not like that, you don't even go there.
You
let them
do,
you know, what's
in.
Going on. Yeah,
yeah,
and
you
there
get
they
boxed
are.
In into the third dimension, and it, you know, it's a well, people in some of the metaphysics literature, they've said the third dimension is actually a prison. It's a prison because the violent cannot get out of it. You know, the third dimension is, you know, is they can't ever go beyond the third dimension until they become more peaceful and more, you know, loving and more empathetic. And
which
then
this sort of,
their mind can expand into other dimensions, and they can meet other beings, and they can meet
And they're
other,
always happier. They're always happier.
Yeah.
They always feel like, wow, you know, if I'd known this, I would have enjoyed my whole life of like a thousand times more. And
right.
You tell them, well, you know, you're the one who did that. You did it. We didn't do it. You just figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
People feel good. Yeah.
That's true. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. It's been a delightful hour of great discussion. I would invite you back when your next book is out.
I'd love to, because, it's, you know, obviously after I work through some more discussion of the, you know, the most
sure.
recent stuff.
Well,
yeah.
When it's, you know,
great.
When you've got it for sale, we can discuss
to.
It again. Because this, you know, Alien Mind, the thought and behavior of extraterrestrials is a little disturbing, as you probably know. It's a disturbing picture. And I think that what you're doing with your second book is doing the counter thing to this book and showing
exactly.
how it really is.
Yeah, this book can
and
be
that,
you can be
good.
Entirely positive about this one. You see an offender case, but you feel so far beyond that. That this one, I think, in a way, is like, I just feel very positive about it.
Yeah.
I love talking
great.
About it on the radio.
Great. Well, thanks so much, George, for joining us. It's been delightful, and I look forward to reading your new book.
Thank you for having me on.
All righty. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. We've been interviewing George Lobono, Alien Mind, the Thought and Behavior of Extraterrestrials. Please join us next week.